Why are Americans obsessed with their lawns?
That's a good question. The grass is the number one cultivated crop in the United States. And that seems sort of improbable, especially when you consider that there is no such thing as native turf grass in the United States. Every lawn you've ever walked on is grass that came from someplace else. It came over with immigrants and their livestock from other parts of the world, breeds of grass that co-evolved with livestock as forage. So there's no native American turf grass. So we went to a great deal of trouble to produce it, and now we have a lot of it, and it's a nuisance.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with David Owen about his book, Where the Water Goes, Life and Death Along the Colorado River. Together, we'll follow the river and tackle tough subjects about water rights, conservation, and the laws of human comfort. What's your connection between golfing, grass, and water issues?
I think, like most Americans, I am a consumer of lawns, which depend on water, and I'm a golfer, so I have an intimate connection with grass, with cultivated grass. But we really all do. It's the grass is everywhere, and it's a part of the, I think, in most places, in cities, in people's houses. It's part of what people like about the place where they live. I was talking to the head of the water utility in Denver, and he was saying that, if you took the grass away from Denver, if you took away the grass and the trees, it would be a place where people wouldn't want to be. It's a big part of what people like about what they are. So, mm-hmm. But like most of the comforts that we think of, have come to think of as necessities, it has an environmental cost, as do all the parts of our affluent lives that we're incredibly fortunate to lead in this country.
Right. And I want to get into the give and take of the environmental issues and energy issues a bit later. But your book begins by talking about the fact that even though many of us might consider ourselves nature lovers or environmentalists, many of us have no idea where our actual day-to-day water comes from. What's the best way that we can do homework to find that out?
Actually, you can find it online, and people are often surprised. I know very clearly where my water comes from because last week the pump in my well broke, and my wife and I had to call a plumber and have an emergency visit from a plumber who hauled up 250 feet pipe and electrical cable, and to replace the pump, and then to replace the control box in the basement. And so for that knowledge of where our water comes from has a half-life. It's a week later and I'm already not thinking about it when I turn on the tap. But for 48 hours, we were very aware of where our water came from.
Right.
Other places where, people who live on, depend on public utilities, you can go to your municipalities website and find out where the water department gets its water. It's often a revelation for people. You would think that people who live in the West would know very clearly where their water comes from just because water has been such an issue for them for a long time. But it's not the case. And it's especially true with the Colorado River because it's a relatively small river, medium-sized river, yet tens of millions of people depend on it. And because most of those people live a great distance from the river, they don't have the connection between their water and their river is not obvious. And so they often guess wrong when they have to guess about where their water comes from.
Right. David, can you describe the process of research for where the water goes?
Well, what I wanted to do was I wanted to follow a river from beginning to end to see where the water came from and where it goes. the Colorado is perfect for that because it's 1,400 miles long, so it's kind of big, but it's also manageable. And it has this unique feature that it doesn't get all the way to the end. The water runs out before it gets to its natural outlet at the northern end of the Gulf of California. So we not only use it, we use it up. And what I did is I began actually in an airplane flying over the headwaters and then made several trips in rental cars along the river. I didn't float down the river. I drove along it and around it and through the communities that depend on it, and ended up where it actually runs out in Mexico. And so it was a series of car trips that were kind of sort of planned, but also had an attractive, aimless quality to them, but always generally following the river from the beginning to its semi-tragic end.
And the book reads like a travelogue, or it felt like I was on a road trip with you. And I'm just wondering if you can begin by reading us a little section from the beginning of the book.
Sure. The Colorado suffers from the same kinds of overuse and environmental degradation that increasingly threaten freshwater sources all over the world. As the global population rises toward its projected mid-century level of 9 or 10 billion, and as changes in the weather play havoc with accustomed precipitation patterns. Climate change is water change, a scientist told me. Water challenges in the United States are less dire than those in places like India, Syria, and Brazil, but they're similar in kind. They also involve much more than water, since they're inextricable from equally thorny challenges concerning energy, economics, governance, democracy, and climate. Water problems are straightforward in one way. Without water, we die, and not centuries from now. When supplies are short, people have no choice but to find solutions one way or another in real time. They change behavior, cut back consumption, develop new sources, negotiate treaties, pass legislation, all right now. And we know that happens because in dry places all over the world, there's evidence of it every day. Water problems in the western United States, when viewed from afar, can seem tantalizingly easy to solve. All we need to do is turn off the fountains at the Bellagio, stop selling hay to China, ban golf, cut down the almond trees, and kill all the lawyers. As you draw closer, though, you realize that every new solution creates additional problems, and that tinkering with even small elements in the river's vast network of beneficiaries can upset dozens of others. Addressing everything effectively, equitably, and permanently will force us to weigh the kinds of choices we prefer to avoid. We haven't had much success with that sort of thing in the past, but who knows?
David, there's an ominous, slightly ominous tone to this book, but it's tempered by references to jet ski mailboxes and ceramic frogs from RV parks. And I'm wondering how intentional that choice was. Also, knowing that you've been listed as one of the top 50 funniest writers, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I wanted it to be fun to read, and my wife always reminds me when I write about the environment, I shouldn't make people want to kill themselves. And I had a great time following the river. It was really a tremendous experience. I got to travel through a part of the country that, when I was young, I thought would be my home when I became an adult.
Right.
And it's some of the most remarkable topography on Earth. And I never understand why people think they want to go to Mars if they haven't been to the national parks in southern Utah, and to get to drive through that whole part of the country and to nose around without a real itinerary other than to sort of generally follow the river was a tremendous experience. And I got to break it up into several trips, so it kept being fun. I kept having a chance to do it again.
Right. What's the law of the river?
Western water law is different from water law any place else in the world. In my part of the country, in Connecticut, and in England, which is the source of many American laws, water is divided equitably among people who own property adjacent to it. So if there's a stream that flows past my property and yours, we're required by law to sort of share it in a fair manner between ourselves. In the West, water is so scarce that doesn't work, as was discovered during the gold rush. During the various gold rushes, if a miner was diverting water to run through his sluice box as he was looking for gold, he needed a large volume of water. And if another miner came along and made a claim upstream and diverted some of that water, suddenly he didn't have enough to do what he had been doing. And that led to disputes and gunfights and things like that. And eventually what evolved was a different system where the right to use water was governed not by proximity to it, but by your place in time, in line in time, first in time, first in right. The idea was that the first person to make beneficial use of water from a stream gained the right to use that much water for that purpose in perpetuity, and to move the water over distances. And always proximity didn't matter. So this is a kind of an entirely different way of thinking about water. The general concept is called prior appropriation, which basically means first dibs. And then this whole prior appropriation idea is kind of the central piece of what's known as the law of the river. And the law of the river is a collection of laws and customs and beliefs and habits that govern how water from the Colorado River gets used.
Can you also explain the phrase, the rain follows the plow?
There was, during the settlement of the West, there was a lot of false advertising that was meant to lure people from the East to the West. And one of the ideas was that rain follows the plow. The idea was that if you began cultivating land in a dry part of the country, that would somehow attract precipitation. The piece of land that you were intending to farm might look very unpromising once you began cutting up the soil with your plow. Supposedly, the precipitation pattern would change, and you would receive enough rain to grow crops. And there were just sort of accidentally some years in which the West got more than its accustomed amount of precipitation in places where settlers from the East have come. So it looked as though maybe it was true, but it wasn't. And the whole idea was one of many that were responsible for a lot of sort of ruined lives during the Western expansion of migration of people from the East to the West.
Along with that, it does seem like in retrospect, we can look back on that and laugh and think, oh, how silly. And yet one of the things you point out over the course of the book is science is always changing. And so there's maybe we have to look with a generous eye to that, the fact that maybe we were doing the best we could as we were developing these giant, you know, civil projects that have turned out to kind of create new problems for us these days. Does that resonate or make sense to you?
Yeah, sure, it does. And it's there are also, you know, they're just sort of accidents of timing. The seven states that border either the Colorado or the tributaries to it, which Montana just misses. Wyoming is one of those states. Montana is not quite. When they divided up the river among themselves, beginning in the 1920s, and they made their division based on the best science at the time, which had estimated that there was more water in the river than there actually is, and it was not because the scientists were measuring the wrong thing. It was because through the sort of perversity of history, those happened to be the very wettest years in centuries for the Colorado River. So when they measured the amount of water in the river, they were measuring an unusually large amount. And because the division was based on a specific volume rather than on percentages, this has become a big problem recently as the river just doesn't have as much water in it as the law pretends that it does.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with David Owen about his book, Where the Water Goes, Life and Death Along the Colorado River. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the next segment, David clarifies why it's so hard to conserve and why my weekend jaunt into the wilderness might not be in the Earth's best interest. David, I grew up in the part of the United States where it rained 220 days a year on average and upwards of 90 inches a year. And so if you had asked me, where does the water come from, I would have said the sky. But if you asked me, you know, where does your apple come from, I would have said maybe I would have known enough to say Washington State. But the carbon footprint of that apple must have been extraordinary. Can you talk about the interrelationship of these issues of energy and conservation?
Yeah, they're so complex, and in the United States especially, we are by far per capita the world's leading energy consumers and climate despoilers and resource extractors. And you know, untangling the exact pathways of all of our consumption is impossible because they're so complex. But yes, there are these very we consume a lot and it has major impacts, and you can't always just say, well, I'll stop doing this, I'll stop eating almonds, and then I'll have shrunk my carbon footprint, because it probably doesn't. The main part of your carbon footprint is so deeply woven into your life that pulling one thread out of it isn't going to make a difference.
Why is it so hard to conserve?
It's hard to conserve. What we tend to do when we think about reducing our carbon footprint is just to sort of switch around, trade one form of consumption for another. I'll use recycled materials when I redo my kitchen. I'll drive a different kind of car. I'll get better about putting my recycling out. All these are sort of just around the very, very outermost edges of our real environmental impact, which goes much deeper. I mean, we live, even those near the median of the income scale in the United States, live much better than kings during most of human history. We have this extraordinary access to luxuries, to energy. We consume the equivalent of, I remember reading from someone, you know, the equivalent of entire herds of draft animals, just, you know, in the form of the SUV that you take to drive to the grocery store. It's all kind of invisible to us because it's just our life. But we're major consumers. For example, when I was growing up, I was born in 1955, and when I was a young child, there was very little air conditioning in the United States. We now, today, use more electricity to run air conditioners than we did for all purposes when I was a young child. And yet it doesn't, you know, we don't think of our lives as being that dramatically different.
Right. It reminds me of this sentence where you describe the Moore's Law of Human Comfort. And I'm wondering, can you give an example from your current life where you think you're making an exchange, you know, that's maybe going mm-hmm. to help conservation, and then it turns out you just find another way to use it?
Yeah, in 2008, when the price of oil went crazy, and I live in a 230-year-old house that for insulation it basically has dust and mouse poop and very little else. And so, I mean, we could just put the furnace in the yard for all the good the house does and block keeping heat from – the heat just goes right up through the roof. My furnace runs on home heating oil, which is the same as diesel fuel. And it was suddenly – it cost about almost $5 a gallon. And I was in a panic. And so I thought, well, we're going to get much better. So I did some insulation projects that I'd been meaning to do since we moved into the house 20 some years before. And I, you know, blocked up drafts and got much better at turning off lights and turned down the thermostat and had a real impact and actually reduced our electric and fuel bills by a noticeable amount. But then, you know, that savings, which was considerable, my wife and I then spent, you know, on an anniversary trip to Europe. So the real effect of our conservation efforts was just to transform natural gas, which most of the electricity had been generated by burning, into jet fuel. So it wasn't a reduction in our impact. It just kind of changed the complexion of it, changed the composition of it.
Right.
And this affects all our efforts to be better environmental citizens. The difficulty with energy efficiency, as you become more efficient, you feel as though you're making a contribution to reducing your carbon and energy footprint. But what the actual impact depends on what you do with what you save. And for that reason, your electric bill is a less revealing indicator of your environmental impact than your tax return is, because what our impact really correlates with is our level of affluence.
Yeah.
Climate change, energy shortages, these are all really functions of our ever increasing affluence. The wonderful luxuries that we have by comparison with what people a century ago had.
David, the questions that I kept coming back to was the ethics of recreation. You know, out here we're alpine skiers, and I don't think twice about driving 4 hours to and from a trailhead, you know, and thinking that that's my highest best purpose for the day. I don't know.
It's a really good question, and it's because environmentalists have sort of trained us to think of that, you know, cross-country skiing or hiking as good not just for us, but good for the environment. And there are a number of arguments that are made, just the idea that you have to expose people directly to the wild to make them appreciate the importance of preserving it. But you could also, this is really a pretty self-serving argument. It's somebody, this is a very high energy pastime, a large impact pastime. Maybe I shouldn't be doing it, or maybe I don't feel as bad about it as I should. And I had a discussion with somebody in San Francisco who was saying he was angry about the traffic congestion on highways heading north out of San Francisco, because he liked to go hiking in the mountains, and he viewed the traffic congestion as a big environmental problem. And I'm one of the few, maybe the only person who argues for the environmental value of traffic congestion, because I think that anything that makes you unhappy to be in your car is probably good for the environment, and conversely, that anything that makes you happy to be in your car is probably bad. And so I said that rather than eliminating that congestion, making people feel even better about getting in their car and just heading out, it would be more environmentally sound to think about increasing traffic congestion to reduce the car carrying capacity of roads leading out of town. And he was appalled by that, because in his view, his hiking had value for the environment, not just for him, but for the environment. So I think this is a tricky one. We almost always interpret our solutions to environmental problems almost always end up making things better for ourselves. And I guess I think there are probably two kinds of climate change denial. One kind is the obvious kind, the kind that where you say that scientists don't know what they're talking about. But the more insidious kind, I think, is the belief that it's a sufficient response to climate change simply to be angry at those people and not to really think about what would actually sustainable human life look like. I think it would look very different from the way we live. And none of us, for good reason, none of us are eager to pursue that.
I feel crestfallen. So... Before we end, David, what do we do, or where's the silver lining, or can you just tell an anecdote from an RV park somewhere?
I think there is a silver lining. Certainly with water, there's a silver lining. Our water problems, in comparison with what's happening in other parts of the world, we don't have anything. Our mismanagement of the Colorado River, if that's what it is nothing like India's mismanagement of the Ganges. We don't have the same kind of problem. The problems that are faced by millions of people in large parts of the world. At the same time, though, we're the big hitters in environmental impact, and it's perfectly within our capability to live in a way that would truly be significantly less significantly less of a problem for everybody else, and ourselves included. But it's very hard to do. I think, you know, people, we tend to think of the issue as, do we have the will to make a sufficient investment in wind and solar? When in fact, the real question is, do we have the will to leave some very large proportion of all the Earth's remaining store of fossil fuels in the ground untouched forever, you know, always, for always? And that's a very different question, and we all answer no to that in a variety of ways every day. So I think we're fully capable of solving these problems. In a way, it's too bad that our environmental problems are not catastrophes, immediate catastrophes. I was thinking, you know, if an asteroid were speeding toward the Earth and scientists were certain that it was going to strike Earth in, say, 40 years, you can easily imagine all the, you know, the countries of the world laying down their arms and the best minds from all over the world getting together to figure out how we're going to prevent this calamity from happening and coming up with an ingenious solution that would actually work. But the climate and other environmental issues don't have that same kind of concrete deadline. It's incremental. It's not the Earth won't be destroyed in a flash. We're sort of picking away at it a little bit at a time. And it's much harder to marshal permanent, focused concentration and energy on a problem like that. You know, even around your house, that's the hardest kind of home improvement job to tackle. You need a crisis. You need a leaking roof,
right,
to kind of get you off your feet and doing something. So, but you know, we've as a species, we've in addition to all the havoc we've wreaked, we've also been pretty ingenious at solving the problems that we've created. So I have faith that we actually will figure these things out.
Despite his love affair with the Colorado, David lives in Connecticut. He's been a contributor to the New Yorker and Golf Digest since the 1990s. He's also listed as one of America's top 50 funniest writers. Look for more information about David and Where the Water Goes at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.